About fucking time, right?
Yeah.
You ready?
Oh, yeah. Let's do this.
Welcome back.
Are we gonna do like an intro, so like of where we've been?
We've been busy.
I was just gonna say I was on my Captain America shit and with like frozen in ice for a few years.
I'd like to say I did something cool, but the fact that you're like you've started a PhD program now, I think is way cooler than I've changed tech jobs and I'm a real life data scientist now.
Don't say that because Webster defines a masochist as a person who derives sexual gratification from being subjected to physical pain or humiliation. And I feel like that's a better way to summarize where the fuck I've been, because I'm back in grad school.
Inexplicably back in grad school. No one can explain why you're back. But that's fine, because you're here now, and we have time to do this again, because there's a global pandemic.
Yeah, experiments are done. I can't test my undergrads anymore.
God, you'll have to... What was it that you said Reviewer 2 is just going to have to deal with your N of 45 because...
No, 71. No.
Okay, so you have a sample size of 71. That's better than I thought, and that's better than one of the papers we're going to talk about, so that's good.
Well, like, if I'm super nitpicky based on my power analysis, which is what every good experiment is supposed to do, I needed 84 to detect a moderate association, so I'm a bit shy. But yes, 71 is much better than what we usually end up seeing in a lot of social science research.
True. But here we are. I'm actually firmly in the tech world now. I am actually a real-life data scientist.
Woo!
In some ways, actually kind of doing the stuff that I really wanted to do when I was in academia in the first place. So I truly can't complain. It's been pretty fun.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Yeah, so welcome back. And to anybody who's still been listening to us over the course of the last year and a half in which we haven't recorded anything, we thank you for your boredom and dedication.
Yeah, really appreciate it. I've even gotten just like some really good feedback from just a few friends who like started listening to it during the gap, and they're like, this is really good, you guys should get back to doing it. So we're super excited to get back and record, and now that everyone's physical distancing, here we are.
Yeah, so social distancing, it is what it is. But we're here to start for, I think, what would really had us come back this time around was to talk about some of the bad fucking science around this coronavirus pandemic that's going on. And it's funny, but it's also terrifying. And we'll do our best to keep it light because I know right now everybody's scared. But there's a lot of dumb shit going on right now. And it, you know, like there's bad science on any given day, but there's also like right now, a lot of the misinformation that's going around is doing more harm than good. So we're going to pick a few things apart, and we're going to do so probably over the course of two episodes between now and the next couple of weeks. So welcome back. We hope that you take the time to listen to this. And if just my personal recommendation, if you see bad science going around, call it out. It can actually do more harm than good.
Absolutely. Do not feel intimidated to call out some bad science just because the people doing it may be at some, you know, high price university or have like 1,000 degrees. All of these people and all of these institutions are susceptible to bad research, bad science when they do it poorly. And when we see bullshit, call bullshit where it is.
Always. So I think one thing that we'd like to start with was actually a blog post that Devin found on really just a blog post that's sort of a, how do I put it? A call to non-action for data scientists who don't know what the fuck they're doing.
And yeah, like I found this blog post on LinkedIn, and it was interesting because sort of if like, as soon as people were just, like, stuck in their homes with social distancing, physical distancing, we're just seeing a ton of data scientists and statisticians just pulling openly available data and just creating their own analyses and just publishing those, whether that was on Twitter, I think sometimes even preprints, so kind of, like, published papers before they're published or just in their initial state before peer review.
I auto-generated a PDF to make this look like a peer-reviewed paper kind of thing.
And so on one hand, it's amazing that we have this open data and that a lot of people who have the skills to pull this data in and play around with it can see what's going on. On the flip side, it's a situation in which, yeah, if someone just really knows R or Python and a little bit of stats, they can, you know, tell a story with some of this open data, but don't have the content background. And I know the call to arms in this, or the call to non-action in this blog post was, listen, unless you've got like a peer-reviewed published paper in like epidemiology, unless you know about viral diseases, maybe not share every RMD or Jupyter notebook you have with a cool visualization or some statistical model, because it's probably not the story that needs to get out right now.
Yeah, holy shit. And I get the desire to help. You know,
yeah.
The majority of the data scientists and folks in tech that I know are shut in their apartments, have been so for the last week or more, are dealing with some form of shelter in place if you're in New York or the Bay Area, like myself in New York City. There is a level of restlessness. There's a level of, I think, just powerlessness where folks really do want to do some good. And
oh, yeah?
I don't doubt the intentions. Like, I don't doubt the intentions of the majority of people who are doing this. But at the same time, like, if you're in data science, more often than not, you and or some of your colleagues probably left academia and understand that, I mean, we've bitched about it many times in the past. The peer review process is flawed, but the solution isn't, I did a fucking thing, I put it on Twitter. You know,
yeah,
that's not the future of peer review. That's not science. That's not good science. Like, somebody in some area of domain expertise has to be able to contribute to what you're putting out there.
Absolutely.
The domain expertise part of the data science, like, set of concentric circles. If you know anything about the field, you know there's the whole, oh, what's a data scientist? It's three concentric circles of expertise. You've got statistics, you've got computer science, and you've got domain expertise. And the domain expertise is very often neglected. Where it's like, yeah, you know, you need to actually understand the topic that you're doing. Just because you did one Kaggle competition with some kind of healthcare expenditures data doesn't mean that you actually know what you're doing.
Whoa. That Kaggle data set I got where I ran like one linear regression, that doesn't make me an epidemiologist?
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I'm not an epidemiologist, which makes me... But I am a data scientist, which means I'm qualified to tell you that you're an epidemiologist. Congratulations.
Well, I think when you bring up a really good point. Without that domain knowledge, with data in general, whether it's social sciences, I mean, hell, we can even see some of this in the natural sciences. If you're just taking data at face value and just playing around with it, and in many instances, you're just creating, you can create any kind of story. If you have data, you can create any story. I mean, as a data analyst, before I came back to academia, a lot of times the data was just there for us to create some kind of story and create a narrative around it. And unless you have that deep domain knowledge and know the best story that the data is telling, you're just going to be throwing out a bunch of stuff that's can either be confusing or not productive or counterproductive in a lot of instances. And so I was really happy to come across that blog post, at least to see that the conversations being had out there amongst data professionals and data specialists to just go, yeah, this is fun. It's nice. It's nice that we have this data, but let's maybe pump the brakes. I think all this data on the outbreak and how it's spreading is going to make some phenomenal educational opportunities for data scientists in training. I mean, if we want to stop, you know, using like Iris data set and move forward with like other stuff, like, you know, we're going to be in a really good position to, you know, train people up on, hey, here's here's a bunch of data that's, you know, that was very real world applicable, and you know, here's how you can take it, play around with it, and construct a story.
Speaking of, I explained correlations to a colleague of mine last Friday in using information about the current global pandemic, and I think it was probably the best, like, 30-second explanation for what correlations are that I've ever come up with. So I'm happy to share it with you here. So we had presented the results of a correlational analysis to a team who, a couple of folks were familiar with correlations. A few folks asked for just a quick refresher. So I quickly went through the 30-second explanation. Correlations range from -1 to 1. The closer it is to -1 or 1, the stronger the relationship. The closer it is to 0, the weaker the relationship. The sign of the relationship, negative or positive, tells you the direction by which things are related. A positive correlation is time spent in home and amount of anxiety you experience. A negative correlation is number of people who stay the fuck home and the number of COVID cases that you will experience locally.
Given that I'm still a child of frequent statistics, is that correlation statistically significant?
Yes.
Is that p-value less than 0.05 so I can reject my null?
Yes.
But instead of rejecting my null, misinterpreting that and assuming that I have support for my hypothesis.
Yes.
Oh my god, we're nerding the fuck out right now. Just a bunch of stat shit.
Oh my god. But I think just one last thought that I have on the whole topic of data scientists contributing. Don't go off on your fucking own. If you want to be useful, get in contact with your old university. Get in contact with some of the universities with epidemiology departments and folks who maybe are super busy working on research and could use some kind of statistical support. Like, don't pretend that you know everything. If you want to contribute to the work being done by domain experts, do it. But don't pretend that you know everything, where like entire teams of people are busting their asses pretty much 24/7 right now to try to find vaccines, cures, develop projections. Don't do it on your own. Go and work with people, like work with experts, contribute to the experts. You do have skills. You do have great skills. We complain all the time about the shitty use of statistical methods in academia, and that exists well outside of psychology research. Go and contribute to work
too
that's
close
being
to home.
Done. Always, always too close to home. But make a difference in the good work that is being done. This isn't about your goddamn ego.
Yeah, just speaking on that, in terms of getting involved and having that collaborative nature of this, I mean, you've got the data, you've got the skills. That's amazing. Science is collaborative. I think for data scientists, it's excellent because they're on the outside looking in when it comes to the bullshit, when it comes to academia. So they're ripe for, I know how to do these amazing things in terms of pulling the data and running the models, communicate with the academics who have the domain specificity. And yeah, you can do really good. And then you as data scientists won't have to worry about this slow humdrum peer review process. You can just go, hey, you need like this kind of model done. I've done it in like 15 minutes. Here you go. I'm going to go back off and do my own thing. Email me if you have any further questions, and you don't have to deal with the bureaucratic nonsense that's academia.
Yeah, and maybe 2 years from now, you'll get 12th author on a paper you don't really give a shit about.
Throw it on your CV. Maybe you could get a, you know, a research assistant position somewhere. I don't know. What is 12th author worth nowadays?
I don't know. I lost track of that. The answer to that question a while ago. Can't help you there. It's been officially like 4 years since I've left grad school, so like I've spent more time out of grad school than I spent in grad school, and I'm okay with that. Like, it's fine.
What's been creepy or was really weird for me is coming back, because I had like a 4-year gap since I left grad school. Coming back, the weirdest thing for me is like coming in like, I'm super excited to do my research, and like every person I meet is like, why did you come back? You had a job. You had a steady income.
You found the exit and you came back anyway.
You could leave your office at 6 p.m. Ugh. The fuck are you doing back here?
Well, let me know when you figure out the answer to that question.
It's an ongoing conversation I have with myself.
Well, I think, as far as ranting towards data scientists, that's mostly what I've got. I don't know if Devin, you have anything else on your mind around that.
I mean, like I said, I think the data scientists present an excellent opportunity to work with academics with that domain specific knowledge. It can create a really powerful collaborative working relationship in which you've got the academics who are good at dealing with the bureaucratic nonsense of the institution, but then also like know the theory and know what they're looking at, know the raw data really well. And then the data scientists who are just like, I'm just going to sit on my couch in my fancy office or in my home now.
No longer your WeWork or whatever.
WeWork done?
I'll let you know.
Okay.
They're certainly empty right now, I'll tell you that.
So I think the academics and data scientists can have a really fruitful collaborative working relationship, but yeah, it's not a matter of just I've got a really good plot in Seaborn and I'm just gonna post that anywhere.
Really? Plotly is where it's at. That's what really gets you attention from CNN.
I'm ggplot all day.
Fine.
Ggplot or die.
Okay. That's fair. I won't argue with you on that.
Hey.
I never would have argued with you on that. I have been using Python in my work for, I think, a while now, a couple years. But no, ggplot's still my favorite.
I'm so upset because I'm getting pulled to Python more and more. And I'm just like, but I like my R. It's beautiful.
I know.
I was so nice and cozy with R.
I am the only person on my team who uses R, and I'm just the R person, and I don't even use R, except occasionally when I build some things that exist in isolation, I'm like, I could make this an R, because fuck all of these Python people, but no, I get it. This is the pull towards Python, and whatever, hiss indeed, whatever like strongholds in R still exist, I understand and I appreciate. And I think a lot of that is within, you know, epidemiology. Also, if you want to just add like one last thing, there is like there are well built out packages in R for different subfields of biology and stuff like that.
Yep.
And then if you come along being like, look at this thing I built from scratch in Python, it took me an hour, I bet it's better than this thing that took years.
Yep. Shout out to my R community. Love
you
guys.
R community.
Everybody's R community then.
It is, yeah, it's everyone's community. But yeah, I think the main thing that, or at least like the one big topic that I definitely wanted to talk about today was one key piece of misinformation that I saw circulating online. And thankfully it doesn't seem to have gotten around too far. But
okay.
It was alarming enough that I was just like, okay, what the fuck? So it seems like there was an article that was put out by one source. I don't actually know like who wrote the article, but a couple of friends that I had known had posted online that they had seen a theory or like some doctors that were saying that a certain medication called spironolactone was tied to worse symptoms and or susceptibility to COVID-19, and cited.
Holy shit!
Yeah.
So you're gonna have to walk me through this. First of all, like, what is this drug? What's it used for?
Yeah. So spironolactone is, I believe, a blood pressure medication. So it is often used for that. It is also an anti-androgen, so it is often used for testosterone blocking for folks who are in some type of like hormone replacement therapy if they're transitioning gender presentations, transgender folks. Yeah, it's a common anti-androgen. So the context in which I was seeing it shared was, hey, folks who are members of this community that I'm seeing that this may make you more susceptible to COVID, don't take your medications, which the fear around that is real. Like, you don't necessarily, like, it's scary if you think that an entire community based on, like, the shared use of one or more medications may be more susceptible to this global pandemic. especially if folks are also like in a community where folks tend to be underemployed, discriminated in multiple contexts in employment, maybe lacking access to quality healthcare. That's pretty fucking scary. And the articles that were posted as quote unquote the nitty gritty details of where those associations were, I had seen them posted by a number of folks who weren't entirely clear on what they contained. So I spent my Sunday morning digging through them, learned a hell of a lot about biology papers and why I don't like biology papers. And maybe that's a bigger story for another day, but I was just confused.
Oh no. So I was moving to the biology papers because I got so sick of the psychology papers. Now the biology papers suck too.
Okay. Damn. Look, okay. We're going to do a read along for some of these because it's ridiculous. Kudos to folks who are in these fields because I understand how difficult the work is around this. I will say there is like zero accessibility to folks who don't have a serious biology knowledge, and Wikipedia is not helpful either. So I went down a rabbit hole of trying to figure out what a couple of different biology terms were. Okay, like what part of the body is this? What hormone is this, etc. And then it just leads you to more technical terms, and then more technical terms, and then more technical terms. And if you click through all the different links in Wikipedia of this thing is part of this thing, which is part of this other thing. And then the final article I got to was, it's a tube. It's a blood vessel. It's a tube, like a blood vessel or urethra or something. Like just all very broadly, like a tube in the body. And I was like...
So just to backtrack, because you had mentioned a little earlier about some of the research here looking at associations between this medicine and susceptibility. So no experimental conditions. So no experimental research here, just like... looking at associations. Am I correct in that and what you've been reading?
So it did seem like one of the four papers that was being linked was an experiment on mice.
Yes. Now, to be fair, I had a prof during my master's degree who used to say, if we see it in mice, we'll see it in humans.
Look.
Yay or nay?
There's a Twitter account called Just Says in Mice that begs to differ.
I love that page.
Oh, man. So this is actually somebody who does another science podcast called Everything Hurts. Everything H-E-R-T-Z hurts. You know, the sound thing hurts. One of the hosts of that podcast actually created an account called Just Says in Mice, where he just retweeted, press releases and summaries of different studies that were published where it was like, these things have been shown to cause whatever, and then added the important clause at the end, which was in mice.
In mice. Yeah. I mean, I think, keto diet, good for men, not women under these like age groups. And it's like, they actually did the experiment in mice. And obviously in the science communication part, people would just go, oh yeah, this is what's happening in humans. But in the experimental condition, no, it was just in a mouse population.
Yeah, and you can't even map something as simple as age categories directly to humans. And I think in part two of this episode, we're going to have hopefully a friend of mine who can speak more in depth to some of the issues with doing research in mice, as well as these studies in particular. But I think I'm going to keep it pretty simple, just taking a look at this so far. So the broad claim that's being made and shared by people who are scared right now is... this specific drug, which is necessary to facilitate hormone replacement therapy for folks who are looking for like gender-affirming hormone replacement therapy, the claim is that these drugs make humans more susceptible to COVID-19. The first paper, and we'll link to all of these, like I would actually love if anybody understands these papers better than I do to take a good look at them and tell me like what they think about them. So the first paper was a study of 8 mice with congestive heart failure.
Just 8?
Yeah, so let's start with that. An N of 8 mice with congestive heart failure. And the association that was found from what I read was that I think there was some association with like increased risk of susceptibility to, I think it was COVID, but
It's an N of 8.
Yeah, so I mean, like, I'm not a biologist by training. I would find this, like, unfathomable of, like, trying to, like, pump out, like, a finding of some kind of association with a sample size of 8. That is that even possible? Like, is that reliable information? That sounds like, at the best, the pilot to a pilot.
Yeah, abso-fucking-lutely not. And in addition to that, you've also got the co-occurring problem of these mice are in heart failure. So I think that's going to fucking kill them before, you know, anything related to... Yeah, so that was the first terrible paper. The next one, which I'm also going to link to, the second paper I could not make heads or tails of, and I actually ended up sending it to a friend of mine who is a biologist, and I'm hoping will give us more details. But I think this is an example of one of those horrifically very, very difficult to read, inaccessible papers. Where,
hooray!
Yeah, there's a lot of knowledge necessary to get to a point where a lot of the like nitty-gritty details of the different biological systems are understood, but this one was just, this is just like a fun read-along. So the title of the paper is, and pardon me, this is going to be like a bit of an alliteration, is Renin-Angiotensin-Aldosterone System, Pathways, Functions, and Terms.
I tapped out halfway through the first word.
Renin.
Yeah, no, tap that. I mean, like, the dirty little secret behind a lot of these, like, highly, highly specialized papers, the ones that take, like, 2 hours to read one paragraph, is that at the end of the day, I think it's, what, at best, 8 people in the world are the ones who know that paper inside out, the people who wrote it and the people who reviewed it, and they're just very inaccessible and maybe get cited at best for what's in the abstract, but not from what's in the actual paper itself. And this is common in a lot of the sciences.
Yeah, I've seen that too. I mean, that's true in a lot of psych papers where you present it at some talk. You've got 10 people who clap. If you're lucky, 10 people over the course of your life cite your paper. And I don't know, like maybe in some context, somebody builds a piece of useful research off of it. More likely than not, somebody's misinterpreting your abstract to just fill a couple of sentences in their introduction to then publish their own paper.
Yeah. Oh my God. What was that terrible paper? What was that terrible finding that a majority of published psychiatry papers, the abstracts overblow the results? And you've got situations in which acting and practicing psychiatrists who don't have time to read like 30-page paper with like super in-depth detail, just read the abstract and just like, yeah, okay, this medication seems to be good, but the abstract itself way overblows the actual results. And we've got problems.
Yeah, I've seen that in a number of contexts. I also read about in Delusions of Gender, which is a really good book, which talks about just some of the problems with research into differences in, or like gender differences in different topics. And one of the things that the author does is actually dig into a bunch of different papers, go through the introductions, go through the abstracts. And basically what she ended up finding was that the actual interpretations or the like key takeaways that people get from previous papers when they cite them in their intros is way off from what's actually in that paper.
Yep.
Like there's a gross misinterpretation of what's going on in those papers. But I think back on the topic of these four papers. So the second one was pretty dense. From what I understood, it was a review of some details of the renal system. So like your kidneys, your bladder, stuff like that. The third paper, now that one was fun. So that was actually the third link wasn't really a paper. It was like a science news feature that interviewed a scientist who is like specifically a scientist who studies these things, who had just recently issued or like published a 1.5-page review of some points and potential correlates of issues related to certain receptors that may make people more susceptible to COVID-19. If you actually go through the layers of it, basically what's going on is there's like a science announcement or like a press release or like an article that's meant for a more like for a more general audience, where this guy mm-hmm. cites himself in a paper.
The glorious self-cite.
Oh, it just start. It's only just beginning. He cites his one-page review paper where he cites himself, citing himself. And it just kind of keeps going. And then also he says in here, but this has not, like, I have all of these things and here are these, like, associations and whatnot. And then he actually quotes, but this has not been shown in any clinical trials.
Okay, so far what we've got in terms of the evidence to support that this medication, which is used predominantly by the trans community, makes them more susceptible to COVID-19. So far, we've got one study that looked at 8 mice that had heart failure.
Yes.
A super, super technical paper that most likely 3 people actually fucking get.
Yes.
And then homeboy over here, who's at the risk of giving a terribly dated joke, is fucking Inception citing himself. So this is his 1.5 page like review. He's citing himself, but what is he citing? Like, so he's citing a previous experiment he did, or is he just citing like a review he did? Like, what is he citing in all of this, in this like concise document that's supposed to be, you know, supporting this claim?
He's citing a review paper that cites review papers, from what I can see. Like, I went digging into it, and if you look at some of his sources, like, there are some loose associations between, like, certain receptors and certain other diseases. But, like he said, there have been no experiments on this.
So this is just theorizing for the sake of theorizing.
Yeah, and this also...
There's very little experimental data. And this is just, we think it could be like this because that's where the knowledge has us right now. I mean, that's good. There's nothing wrong with theorizing, but coming to a strong conclusion just off of theorizing alone with no data, that's a no-no.
Right. And like, I understand that now in the midst of a global pandemic, we don't necessarily have the like several years it takes to conduct an effective clinical trial, but
of course.
We have people who are sick. We have information on the medications that they're taking. There is live information that can be disseminated and is probably more useful to be disseminated than, I don't know, I think this thing because I thought this other thing because I thought this other thing.
Yeah, no, this, yeah, it sounds like, I mean, this 1.5 pages sounds like the start of a proposal to go off and do the experiments once the data is available to then make a large substantive claim. Not to the point of, yeah, this is a concise article. It's like leading to a strong conclusion that should be disseminated to the larger public.
Yeah, especially not a vulnerable population. And like, I also will say, I took a look at the 4th article here. I can't make heads or tails of it. I'm hoping to go more details into this in a subsequent episode as well. But like, what I did do was look over it with a friend who has an like more of an understanding of this topic. Mm-hmm. And spoke to a couple of other people who read into the papers. And I think at this point, like, the folks that I know that have some understanding of how to dive into and digest papers within different subfields of biology, as well as having a general understanding of, like, scientific bullshit, are in agreement. There is not a sufficient amount of evidence to come to the conclusion that an entire vulnerable population should stop taking their medication. I would argue that's just like, it's a discriminatory tactic and a really stupid and fucked up excuse to spread rumors through a population where it's like, oh, hey, certain discriminatory bodies and groups of people in positions of power can spread information through an entire community to get them to stop doing a thing that we don't want them to do.
Yeah, I think if you're, you know, when we talk about science communication, there's nothing wrong with, you know, the high level papers that you need years of training to understand. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The problem is that when you're using those papers to make substantive claims that you're assuming that, you know, for example, the public should follow or a vulnerable population, the onus is on the researchers and the scientists to communicate that in a way that makes sense. And that isn't just fear-mongering. You can't just put out a blurb that just goes, yep, this medicine's associated with this, stop taking it, or not even say stop taking it, but just make that statement. This is associated with higher susceptibility to COVID-19 without a thorough, concise, but understandable explanation that other people can get and can see why it's happening. And I know a lot of people in the academic community don't think that's necessarily a responsibility they have to be the ones that are communicating their work in a way that is accessible to other people. But I would disagree. I think that's part of the job. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with the high level papers, but what we're seeing so far, if you've got of the four articles, if you have zero, the four bits of information we're diving through, one, weak data, two, nothing but theorizing, and then two, inaccessible papers. So when we start to want to do our own investigation and see what's going on, shit's not holding up.
Yeah. And I think you also, I mean, I think there are a number of points that you really hit the nail on the head with, but like, I would say, please feel free to dig into these yourself. You also, yeah, I think in terms of specifically science communication, you bring up a point that a point from a conversation that I had with somebody recently around, like, is it your responsibility to care about who reads, writes about, cites, and interprets your research? And I think the answer is yeah.
It's absolutely your responsibility. There was this paper that came out recently, I think with a preprint as well, that was looking at the across different scientific disciplines, the proportion of the published papers, their retweets. And so who's retweeting scientific papers, what's the frequency of retweets, but also more importantly, one of the bits of the paper was looking at, of the people who are retweeting, what are the proportion of, you know, that Twitter user's followers that we could reliably categorize that person as a white supremacist. So like, are they following a ton of white supremacist pages? Do they have a lot of white supremacist followers? And so using those kind of ways to categorize Twitter users, what they found in this one paper was that, you know, you had certain key fields in the sciences like genetics and animal behavior as being the most cited and retweeted kinds of studies and papers by white supremacists. And that's very troubling. And I think a clear-cut solution to that is the people doing that research, and it needs to be a collaborative endeavor, get in front of the narrative of what their research is saying. We like to pretend that we can sit down and not engage with the outside world because, oh, our stuff is too hard to understand, or it's just not our responsibility. And that's, you know, to be candid about it, that's absolute bullshit. Science gets used by people for their own purposes, and the people doing science need to be on the front lines of going, this is not what I said, this is not my research is saying, this is not what the field is saying.
Right. And then how often is it actually what ends up boomeranging back to what are the norms within the context of your field? Like, the folks on Twitter maybe retweeting things, misinterpreting things, whatever, but what proportion of them actually end up at some point, I don't know, applying to be a PhD student in your program, or are ex-academics in your field, or have some position of influence where they actually get to decide how to interpret and apply what they think your studies actually mean.
Yeah.
Don't let Nazis decide what your research actually means.
Please don't.
Fucking please.
Don't. I mean, to be fair, at the risk of opening myself up to a ton of criticism, one of the reasons why I shifted away pretty heavily from evolutionary psych as my primary research area. So I, you know, did my MSc in evolutionary psych. That was like my track to do, like follow that through the PhD. Shifted away from that. One of the reasons, many reasons, but one of the reasons why I actually shifted away from that field as the main theoretical framework upon which I conducted my research was this resistance I saw in the subfield to, and then in certain instances, get in front of the way the research was being taken advantage of or purported by anywhere from white supremacists to men's rights activists to incels, you know, in terms of like gender studies, the sex differences research. And it was kind of like a inertia when it came to, hey, we should do something about the fact that Breitbart's retweeting some of the shit or writing articles about some of the research we do to justify certain gender stereotypes and gender hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
that lack of enthusiasm or just lack of even will or interest to kind of prevent that stuff from happening kind of turned me off just from the work in general.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think maybe, I don't know, the last part may be a little bit of a tangent on what we were talking about earlier, but I think it's just as important of a point around caring who gives a shit about what your research says, but also like as part of a broader theme that whatever role you happen to play right now, I think it's more important right now to be extremely like cautious and responsible with your science.
Absolutely.
And even if you're not doing work related to, I don't know, COVID directly, use this as a reason to really, I think, just take a good look at the work that you're doing and take a look at whether or not there are things that maybe have been blind spots to you in the past that could potentially do harm in one way or another. We're in a pretty difficult time right now for a lot of people, and I expect that, I don't know, over the next couple of weeks, a lot of things about the world are going to change.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, like whether it's data scientists trying to be helpful and understand trends in COVID, whether it's releasing blurbs about susceptibility of medications that folk use for their own legitimate purposes, science needs to be transparent and open both within the specialist and to the larger community. We need to be having open conversations and collaborative work with people who are just as skilled as us, who are more skilled than us. That needs to be open, transparent, so that we can get the best work done. And then simultaneously, when it's time to have the conversations with the general audience, just as much effort needs to be done in ensuring that we're putting out a message that people can understand, that people can engage with. And I think what's most important, but almost would be a bit scary for the larger academic community, communicating our science in a way so that not only people engage with it, but can push back on it and can actually have conversations with us. There's a hesitancy to kind of do that, I think, because we're just like, listen, we did all the hard work and here's what we found, but we need to be communicating our work in a way in which people can engage with it and ask legitimate questions that challenge the paradigms we're in and make us think and maybe go back to the drawing board. And I think that goes across almost any academic field, any stream of research, and any technical area.
Yeah, 100%. Like, if we see people now, I don't know, hoarding medication or ingesting dangerous chemicals because our president tells them to, on some level that's tied to, or like the mass text messages about how to cure, prevent, and treat COVID by holding your breath for 10 seconds, or, I don't know, standing on your head for 25 seconds, or like taking a salt bath. I don't know. I don't fucking know what it is. But all of this misinformation, I think, in some part comes from, or at least is tied to, a lack of trust in science, in scientists, in professionals in their field. And I'm not saying that's entirely like our fault, but it is something that we can contribute to mitigating in a lot of ways that we choose not to.
Yeah. It's something we can change. And it's tragic because, I mean, what I think, and especially what I think we were striving to do with this podcast, is to get people confident and willing and engaged and energized to have conversations about science, to see where it can go wrong, but at the same time, to develop some trust into it by getting people engaged with it. I think even the title of the podcast, Bad Methods, at least from my standpoint, was just, yeah, people with PhDs and years of training fuck up. So yeah. That doesn't make them gods. That doesn't make them like these ultimate gatekeepers. These are humans who can make mistakes. And when we learn about those things, it kind of tears down that facade and opens up a situation in which we can ask questions about science and not be ashamed to ask questions, because we have a right to have stuff disseminated to us if we're not specialists. And then if we are specialists, to kind of put a little pressure on us to get better at communicating what we're doing and what the work we're doing means.
Yeah. Well,
I think given that this is our first episode back after a long while, I think this is where we're going to stop and cut short. And at this point, I think we're also talking about actually starting to release episodes on a cadence. So please keep an eye out for that. And once again, thank you, as always, for listening to the podcast, listening to our episodes. And we look forward to having more conversations and hopefully bringing on some of our first guests in the coming weeks.
Yay.
Right.
Outside of that, everyone, stay safe. Social distance.
Stay the fuck at home.
Make your grocery runs and beer runs only when you absolutely need to.
There are apps now where you can have beer delivered to you.
Get your beer delivered.